Hello, Radioland. You're listening to 91.7 WHUS Stores. My name is Graham. I'm the host of Darshiv, the weekly radio program where we talk about archives, we talk about research, and interesting uses of those kinds of things that we have at the Thomas J. Dodd Research Center here at UConn. Today's episode is a special one featuring a project that I've been involved with for just over a year now, and I've got a couple of special guests with me to talk about some of the work we've been doing. I'm joined today with Wes Hamrick, who is the Mellon Fellow at Greenhouse Studios. Wes, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And I'm joined with Tom Lee, who is a design technologist who does all of our electronic needs. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thanks, Graham. Thanks for having us.
So the Greenhouse Studios is located in the Homer Babbage Library. It's kind of a, I don't want to say think tank, but it's more of a sort of open working environment. If you could imagine a startup almost in a culture in a library, it's very similar to that. Wes, do you think you could maybe describe for us a little bit about kind of what the Greenhouse Studios does and how you ended up working there?
Sure. Yeah. So Greenhouse Studios, we think of it as sort of an incubator for collaborative research in the humanities. And we tend to emphasize the digital, but not all of our projects end up being digital projects. Some of them end up being analog. One of the things that makes Greenhouse unique in some ways is that we take what's called a collaborative, a collaboration first approach to project design. And so what that means is typically what happens with a lot of digital humanities projects is a faculty researcher, or maybe two, have been doing research on some topic, and at some point they decide that they want to do something digital with that. And so what they would do is bring in maybe someone like Tom, who's a design technologist, a developer. Maybe they bring in like a designer, and they bring those types of folks in at sort of a late stage in the design process, in the project lifetime. And then the, you know, developers or designers sort of implement the project for them. At Greenhouse, what we do is we typically bring the archivists and the designers and the developers into the project team process from the start. So rather than just implementing a project and helping build a project, those folks actually help conceive and conceptualize the project. And we think that has different and in many cases better results ultimately.
And how did you kind of get interested in this kind of work?
Yeah, so my background is in nothing digital at all. It's actually 18th century literature, British and Irish language. I got into digital humanities type stuff through a website that I've been working on for a number of years now with Professor Brendan Kane, who's here at UConn in the history department. It's a website for learning early modern Irish. It's called Leiv, which is the Irish word for reading or to read. And we've been working on that for, let's see, I think 5 years now. And that was really my first experience sinking my teeth into a digital project.
And I know that there's a handful of other projects that have been developed at Greenhouse. And I know, Tom, you've been involved in several of those too. How did you kind of get interested in this field of humanities work?
So I kind of found out about Greenhouse through the digital media design department. At the time, I was finishing up a master's of fine arts there. So I was like studying 3D modeling, 3D rendering, texturing, all that stuff. And I did a thesis project that was using VR. So my time as a grad student sort of coincided with when these like high fidelity VR headsets were coming out. And I really wanted to like do a project that used them just because I was just blown away by the technology. So I made a bartending simulation game, which caught the eye of several professors, including Tom Scheinfeld, who runs Greenhouse Studios. And it just so happens that one of the first Greenhouse Studios projects was, they were thinking about using VR to sort of recreate this historical event. So I got asked to join that team, and I was working sort of part-time on that at first, and then I found out about the position for a design technologist, and I was eager to join on.
That's great. And this is Charles VR, is that the project?
That's right, yeah.
Where you basically built like a VR cathedral with fresco and all.
Yeah, so it's Charles VR is basically a recreation of the coronation mass of Charles V, who was maybe the last Holy Roman Emperor, depending how you think about it.
Cool. So Wes, I guess more specifically, the three of us have been working on a project to more or less do a similar kind of, you know, electronic digital visualization of the past. Can you talk a little bit about Husky Review?
Sure. So Husky Review is, it's an AR, augmented reality app that we're building. The purpose of, I guess the thinking behind this project was that there are all these instances of protest or activism that occurred on the UConn campus here in Storrs in the late 60s and early to mid 70s. And a lot of us who work at UConn and have been at UConn for a long time had no idea that these instances of activism or protest had even taken place. And what we wanted to do was to use augmented reality through the phone to sort of reposition like images, whether it's photographs or documents of these protests or sit-ins or what have you, and reimpose those on the landscape. We've also thought of this in terms of not just augmented reality, but augmented memory. It's kind of a way to sort of use the archives or what material is in the archives to supplement or augment what we see around us in the landscape.
And I know we'd kind of initially had several ideas, right, as the greenhouse model kind of allows, where we just start sort of spitballing, you know, what kind of project would we envision? You know, number one, what's the theme? Number two, what is it going to look like? Number three, where are we going to get whatever to visualize what that is? And I think ultimately we'd kind of come up with this idea about the landscape, right? Like, how are we going to impose something on the landscape about the past that no longer exists? And we're coming up against that a lot with one of the sites, which is where a lot of the student activism happened around campus recruitment in the late 1960s, around the war in Vietnam. And the houses that they used to hold these recruiting meetings in no longer exist. They just got torn down a couple of years ago. So, you know, it seemed like a great opportunity to kind of use technology more or less to like rebuild a house, if you think about it that way. And Tom, to that end, I guess, how do you see this kind of technology working to really, you know, more or less immerse or get people interested in these things who, like Wes said, knew nothing about it?
Well, I'm hoping that what we've been able to do is make these archival documents accessible to a lot of people via it just being in an app that they can download. So I think that removes the barrier significantly for many people who don't even think to go to the archives for anything. It's just it's way more accessible for their it fits into their daily experience more.
Right. Yeah. And what do you think about it, Wes, in terms of, you know, in relation to the other projects maybe you've worked on at Greenhouse? I guess to what degree is this something new and something different, this kind of technology and history merge?
Yeah, I think, the technology is relatively new. You know, if you remember, Graham, one of the instances of augmented reality that we looked at when we were kind of conceptualizing this project was sort of this guerrilla art project that took place in the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and a group of they call themselves guerrilla artists, and they were superimposing their own paintings or doodles or graffiti, if you will, superimposing those onto these really famous and probably valuable paintings by like Jackson Pollock and people like that. And they were sort of imposing their own take on modern art or the modern art establishment onto the, you know, the museum itself. The technology is relatively new. I think one of the things that's really interesting about our project is the way that our design process and the archives themselves really fit together in a really neat, helpful way. It may seem counterintuitive. You're thinking about like cutting edge technology on the one hand and archives on the other. But I think one of the things that helped our project come to a really successful project idea was that we had something concrete through your involvement, which was the collections that you knew about, and you introduced us to those collections. And that really gave us something concrete around which to use the technology and build the project out of.
Right. And I think it's interesting too, just, you'd mentioned the example of people more or less getting to like digitally deface something.
Sure. Yeah.
Like through the museum, here's your ability to take that paintbrush to that thing and not actually do it, but work
right.
as if you are, which is a great sort of element of the archives. Because as we were going through some of the documents, we found similar instances, such as like student paint-ins of institutional areas that
right.
totally broke any kind of code that the university had set up for vandalism and these kinds of things. And then students having to like repaint the protest painting and all of this kind of meta back and forth protest. But I think we'd also kind of initially thought about sculpture. You know, how could we had a fine artist working on our group as well, River
right.
Soma, who's a sculptor, and she wanted to think through how could we actually build something. And, of course, we were coming up against what actually could we put on a university campus, that like wasn't branded, wasn't some kind of corporate plop art that just,
right.
kind of get someone's name on it and put on a campus. And how do you, I guess, visualize, Tom or Wes, how do you kind of see this getting around those kinds of institutional mandates?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think it's worth pointing out that a couple of the instances of protest involved real paint. I think the one instance you were alluding to was the ROTC hangars, which themselves no longer exist. That's one of the sites on our app are the ROTC hangars. And sometime, this was, I believe, in the wake of the Kent State shootings, a group of students, I believe from SDS mainly, occupied the ROTC hangars, declared it a daycare center, and painted it in a rainbow of colors. And after those students were essentially kicked out or they left and ended their protest, and actually a larger group of students came back and repainted the ROTC hangar, whether it was gray or white or whatever, and painted over their graffiti.
Which is fascinating, because we have documentation that shows, here's the other side, maybe the silent majority that did exist at that time.
Right.
We think about like the radical 60s, which is the painters, and then like who was returning things to the status quo in a volunteer brigade, more or less. So in terms of using the archives themselves, I know, Tom, I've been sending you lots of images and trying to collate, these things together. I guess, how have you seen the collections themselves integrate into a project like this where, I'm assuming with Charles VR, you weren't drawing from archival material. Maybe you were going from publications or photographs. Is there too much? Like, is there an abundance of stuff? A lot of times folks have trouble weeding through what is actually appropriate for the thing they're trying to produce. How have you tried to, try and visualize something in the best way possible, given how much there is?
Well, I think one thing that we're able to do that you wouldn't necessarily be able to do at the archives without a lot of special attention is to sort of group materials together in a logical way and sort of create hierarchies of information. And also just add our own copywriting so that we can sort of like lead people through this experience and give them the context for photographs and documents that they may not be able to piece together themselves. So being able to sort of have that auto curation feature really helps, I think, bring people into the fold.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a good question. I think one of the things we're doing is through our app, the Husky Review app, is we're creating a narrative ourselves out of the vast materials that are in the archives, and we're presenting a framework within which to view and understand the kind of raw archival materials. So the flip side of that is that I think one of the things we want to think about now as we finish the project is how we can lead people back to the archives themselves, to the raw materials, And in that way, they can, you know, create their own narratives or do their own kind of research or framing.
Right, which is, because the more that you sort of talk about that, I start to think like, oh yes, like we've curated more or less the history in this particular way. And,
right,
you know, it will take some more unpacking to kind of get the full picture, but here's just a sampling that we've tried to generate in a more accessible way. Also, Wes, could you maybe mention some of the other sites that we've incorporated into the app?
Sure, let me think. So we mentioned the ROTC hangar occupation and paint-in, as they called it. Another site is at the Wilbur Cross building, the main building on campus with the Golden Dome. The Wilbur Cross building in the mid-70s was the main university library before the Homer Babbage Library was built. And the library was the site of a black student occupation or sit-in. Students came in the afternoon, said they were studying, and then when the library closed towards midnight, they refused to leave. And I believe it was the next day they were each dragged out by state police. They practiced passive resistance and had to be carried out. And that protest was to call attention to some of the research that was taking place in on campus by a couple of faculty members. So that's one site. One of the sites we're doing is the graduate student unionization effort that took place around 2013 to 2015. Graduate students at UConn were not unionized before 2015, and we included that in our app, even though most of the sites relate to the late 60s and early 70s. Another site we looked at is the Storrs Congregational Church, which is really prominent on campus. And at that site, there was a student minister named Jack Allen, who I don't think he did a lot of Bible study, but instead he led a group of students in protesting the Vietnam War and protesting the Vietnam War draft. And a lot of anti-war activity took place out of the parish house, which is immediately next to the Storrs Congregational Church.
Okay, so the Congregational Church, much older than the 1960s, but yet, you know, we're trying to just tell this one slice of, you know, the history that happened on campus.
Right.
Regarding that building, regarding Wilbur Cross. I mean, you could do a project like this based on, like, UConn during the Depression era, like what happened in these buildings. Obviously, activism is kind of our focus, but just trying to kind of think about a constellation of memory happening
sure.
on campus and how we go about like visualizing that through one particular narrative. Just so everyone knows, I guess, that this isn't the definitive final sort of say on a history here at UConn.
Right, yeah.
So Tom, maybe for those folks who know far more than I certainly do about like how this stuff works, could you maybe give us maybe a technical schematic or some kind of description of what it is that your phone and, you know, mobile device really does when it interacts with the space in this application?
Well, so for AR in general, there's a lot of different techniques that you can use to sort of superimpose imagery in an environment. And to go back to one of your previous questions, the way we first started was to use like image recognition. So what I did was I went around campus and took some images, some photographs of sites on campus that we thought we might want to use, and then basically fed those into like a machine learning algorithm that this package provides so that it would learn to recognize certain images, and then that would trigger imagery to appear. But that didn't work partly because we were limited by the fact that we knew that we probably couldn't put up markers or anything on campus. So that was one limitation we faced trying to use this particular environment. So what we ended up doing is removing that portion. Instead, we used the ground plane recognition, which basically uses the gyroscope in your phone and like runs computer vision on the actual photo, like streaming view out of your phone's camera to detect where the ground is, and then allow you to place basically like a carousel of archival documents in the space that you're standing in. So we also use a map so that people can find their way to sites if they haven't been to campus before. But the idea would be that you would actually walk to the sites yourself, bring up the corresponding content by placing it on the ground, and then you can kind of see this in the environment that it's meant to be seen.
Right, and so there's kind of this donut, I guess is what it's described as.
Yeah, for now we have a torus, is the technical mathematical term. But yes, we call it the donut. It's the marker that we use to show you where the content's going to be anchored to.
Right, and like Tom said, you can basically see the sites and the things you would interact with from anywhere, but you know, the ability to kind of bridge that gap of physical and memory in one space at that same time through this application is really like a strong feature, I feel like. And it draws a lot, I guess, similarly on technology wise from Pokemon Go, which I think, you know, sort of culturally a lot of folks know of, the ability to more or less like change your landscape with a virtual one to some degree. And so do we have a rough idea of who it is that we want to target this stuff to?
We think one audience for this, of course, would be people who are already at UConn, people who know UConn campus well, but maybe don't know anything about the history, and that would include people like myself. I think another audience for this ideally would be other people with other project ideas in other places, people who have maybe archival material especially, and they want to use that material in a way that calls attention to it and gets people engaged and thinking about some other subject or topic.
Right. I know that there have been other kinds of applications, and just even what Tom had been mentioning in relation to, you know, certain things that didn't work, you know, the process of trying to build some of these things, like the character recognition and the trial and error that it kind of goes through to do these kinds of projects. We'd looked at one called History Pin, which a lot of historical societies use. It's sort of a free application, but it allows you to more or less just generate digital images on your computer on sort of an artificial map that you've superimposed onto a space. So we have that same kind of mapping, more or less. It just allows you now, right, to have this augmented feature as well. And I think one of the things that we discussed was making sure that folks had the ability to like tour through, you know, you could do sort of this history walk, you could,
sure,
kind of immerse yourself in the time by,
right,
trying to just walk through. And I guess how does that change the way that we think about space? If you want to engage in that conversation, just like, you know, you're being led by this thing through this, and you can do that in urban spaces or suburban spaces.
Yeah, I think one of the things we actually want to do was to really take out of the user's take away from the user the ability to control the experience. I mean, I think Tom was talking about using trigger images in the landscape that would themselves like spontaneously trigger the augmented reality experience. And that was sort of our initial vision. And kind of conceptually, like we thought that would be that seemed to fit with our idea of sort of placing these instances of protest and basically forgotten history in general in the viewer's eyes, rather than having the viewer kind of have to, you know, make an effort themselves and go and, you know, push buttons and trigger the augmented reality themselves. But the flip side to that is we just wouldn't have the ability for people outside of the UConn campus to experience the AR experience at all.
Right.
So that was a limitation.
Right. And I think we'd also talked about maybe the ability for folks to add in their own personal collections and trying to, you know, do a crowdsourced element to,
right,
you know, how can we add more engagement with the public to do this? And obviously the trial that we're working on right now is kind of this prototype of how maybe we could build other things like this in the future. But again, I guess because we have this archive, we're able to generate a story that more or less has some historical factual value to it, and,
right,
that seems to stand out more than anything.
Yeah, I think with all digital projects, there's your kind of ideal vision on the one hand, and then there's the limitations of not just technology, but time and human labor that are limitations.
Right. So in terms of how we got to, you know, this final decision through the application, through the augmented reality, Wes, could you talk us through a little bit of how the Greenhouse Studios kind of works in its, you know, iterative ways of thinking? You know, I know there's this big workflow, you know, not, you don't have to be specific on this, but just, it's definitely more of a free form way of working that I've ever been involved in.
Right. So. Yeah, I guess our design process or philosophy, if you will, it comes out of the area of thinking called design thinking. And a key element in that is what's called iterative development. So you take a stab at producing something, you try it out, you test it, you discuss it, think about it, see if it works. And you make a lot of incremental changes to the project, whether that's in terms of the technology or whether that's in terms of your overall conception. And the idea is that if you keep taking these stabs at making the project output better or more in line with your thinking, that the results themselves will ultimately be better.
Right. And you'd mentioned this earlier, but the role to which you rely on folks who don't normally work together or don't have similar backgrounds,
Right. How
has that really played out?
That presents challenges. One of the challenges we continually run into is that some of our team members are faculty members, regular faculty members, so they teach classes. They have summers off, quote unquote, even though they're doing their own research. But they don't, you know, they don't have regular hours. They don't punch a clock. They don't fill out a timesheet. Whereas some of our librarians and archivists do, in fact, keep regular hours. And so the time they spend on a greenhouse project is time away from their regular job, if you will. And, you know, there's questions of supervisor permission and, you know, how many hours people are spending on those projects. So that question of labor has been a challenge. But at the same time, we're really excited about and pleased with the kind of synergies that come out of having people who don't normally work together, like archivists, coders and developers, designers, and humanities researchers. Putting those people together I don't think any humanities faculty member would probably have come up with the Husky Review app idea on their own. I mean, it really was the kind of, it really was the fact that we had the particular team members that we had brought together. Like, that's what led to the Husky Review app coming to fruition.
Right. And I know that was a key element for me wanting to join a project like this, was kind of the, more or less the attempt to level a playing field in what is a traditionally hierarchical academic environment where,
right, sure,
you know, the archivist is seen in service always to be it student or faculty kind of running, you know, sort of the food chain in what the student then takes in and then,
right,
you know, who ultimately kind of gets to make decisions about projects and where their energies go. So I think that's been a really great example of, you know, maybe challenging that a little bit and laying out expectations at the beginning of like who is able to do what, and then how does kind of more or less how can you demonstrate that what we're about to produce is academically relevant and viable,
right?
If it's not just an academic paper, you know, like,
yeah,
how do you show this to be something? And even just having that conversation in an academic environment is unusual and really fulfilling for a staff member.
Right. Great. Yeah. I mean, for this project, I mean, I don't have to tell you, Graham, like, you've been instrumental in the direction the project has taken. And it wouldn't have happened without your involvement. And to your point, yeah, there's a ton of research and conversations and work that needs to be done to figure out, you know, where does something like Husky Review fit in the hierarchy of, you know, publications? How does it count as a publication? Whose publication is it? I mean, we have a group of, what, 6 or 7 people who've been involved, including undergraduates. And yeah, it's not a journal article. It's not a monograph. Departments really don't know what to do with publications like that.
which is always exciting.
throw
more wrenches at the thinkers, right?
Sure.
And in addition to that, I guess, Tom, I wanted to ask you, how has working in that kind of environment been, where, you know, you're jumping from, was it the 15th century Charles VR?
16th, yeah.
The 16th century to, like, you know, 40 years, 50 years ago, to who knows what other project you might be developing things for. What's the work process been like for you?
Well, I'll just say that I love the variety of projects, as you mentioned. I love being able to learn about these new disciplines that I had no prior experience with. And I think one of the great things for me is that I really get an opportunity to work with a lot of different technologies that you just don't find that variety at a lot of other jobs. So I like having that opportunity to learn new things all the time.
I'm curious, too, if this model has any more sort of application to what perhaps the private sector is doing in your field. Like, you know, you're getting access to far more new technologies than I would assume a university usually invests in, especially in a library. I know we're constantly trying to make sure that students get access to new kinds of technology, but without the Greenhouse Studios, we wouldn't most likely have a virtual reality component to learning. Do you feel like this is maybe more of a private sector way to work?
It could be. I think the model of our collaboration might even be more open than a lot of private sector jobs. You know, usually it's just client and consumer. Yeah, so...
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, it's more of a one-way street, I think, in a lot
right.
of
you're
commercial
responding.
Settings.
Yeah, you're kind of doing what is asked from a productivity standpoint, whereas this hopefully has more of a collaborative element. You're giving your two cents about what is possible, what is not, versus like, Tom, do it. Make it happen.
Right. Yeah, but to your point, I think the kind of collaboration we do, it could have applicability in a... you know, corporate or commercial mm-hmm. setting.
And of course, everyone, I think, regardless if anyone actually knows what they do at Google, you know, the idea of the Google workplace feels like it has these elements of just like, you know, your ability to kind of express in whatever way feels natural, and that hopefully will lead to whatever you're going to produce.
Right.
You know? Which sounds really squishy, but ultimately they're like kind of running the show. So it somehow is working.
Yeah, and that's kind of been a longstanding criticism of digital humanities in general, is that it's sort of this sort of neoliberal corporate take on research. You know, involves technology, involves design thinking in our case, which comes directly from, you know, design and in some cases business schools. So yeah, that is something that people often level at digital humanities
right.
folks.
Right. I remember we also looked at another model, and it was shopping for houses. Do you remember this?
I don't know.
Basically taking tours through, I think...
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, basically like trying to get a sense of living inside an environment. And I think we also decided that that was probably going to be a little bit beyond our capacity. Is that right, Tom?
I
do you remember this?
Was this the real estate virtual?
Yeah. Where like you basically would put
tour,
you would walk yourself through a house, which I think would be really
right.
fascinating.
Okay.
Because we've kind of merged a combination of like get into the space and then you can populate what it used to look like anyway.
Right.
But yeah, just thinking through like things that we thought we could possibly try and then ended up with this.
I think that would require a significant web component, which at the time seemed like a daunting task because you'd have to stream all these sets of photographs together and have them stitched. It's a little bit beyond my expertise personally, but you never know. Maybe we'll have somebody come along eventually with that knowledge.
Right. And then just the role of, you know, us thinking through, okay, this is a digital application for the thing that has a screen on it no bigger than like 5 inches by 2 inches. So,
right.
You know, number one, the challenge of you are wanting to look at documents that have a font size that is, you know, minuscule newspaper font from the 60s are you even going to want to read that to that degree on your phone? So we've had to kind of think through this idea, like you can at least demonstrate that these things exist. If you would like to see them in a broader sense and more detailed, you can maybe take them home on a web platform, on your browser, on your personal computer, something like that. But yeah, there's just been a lot of challenges in thinking through how do we actually want this stuff to visualize. And what's been a benefit is having photographs. We had an interview that I'd conducted that's actually appeared on Darshiv in a previous episode with Norman Stevens, the director of the library at the time. So just that element of, I guess, of having the technology to give us more than just a newspaper or an article to read has been a huge asset.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and we're actually linking those materials out of our app too. Like, so how you just mentioned, people may not want to read an entire newspaper in the app, but we're going to have links to all that stuff, to the digital copies on CTDA and...
basically how to find the thing where it lives.
Right.
Yes, tracking it back. So to that end, I guess, so you're mentioning that there's going to be a sort of a web format of this. Do we have an idea of when the public might get to see what we've been working on?
I think if I remember correctly, our goal was to have things sort of wrapped up by end of summer. So... sometime later this year.
Mm-hmm. So you guys can look forward to us promoting that, hopefully to download from anywhere, but more specifically, if you want to check it out on our sort of augmented reality mobile campus app, it's called Husky Review, and it's been a production of the Greenhouse Studios, which has been a really great opportunity to kind of get together with a bunch of different thinkers and produce something interesting. And so to that end, we need to give some shout outs to our other group members. We have Brooke Fodi-Gemmel, a design technologist, Alessandra Tanasini, who's been our sort of outside scholar located in Cardiff, Claire Costley-Kingo, who is a faculty member in the English department. We have Mackenzie Fox working on some more of the digital technology enhancement, and River Soma, who was our fine artist, giving us a schematic of kind of how to think about these things aesthetically. Any final thoughts, gentlemen? Anything else you wanted to talk about? Maybe other projects that you're excited to work on?
We just started the Flusser project, which is a pretty interesting one about this... these scenarios that were written by this Czech Brazilian philosopher. He actually fled World War II to Brazil, and he just writes about media theory and, well, a whole range of things. Animology? There's some weird word for it. But he's a fascinating person, and he has these really vivid metaphors that crisscross in a lot of different ways, and it's going to be a really... I think we're going to create something very surreal. So he's written these scenarios that he intended to actually be turned into imagery. So in a way, I think it's like a very pure prompt for Greenhouse Studios, because these materials were written for us or somebody like us to use and turn into imagery. And I just think, like, no matter what, we're going to fulfill that. Like, and it's going to be really interesting because his writing is really interesting.
Any idea of what kind of visualization, or will it even take that form?
It's a little early to tell. But yeah, there's like maybe 20-ish scenarios or so. So I think it's going to be multifaceted for sure, because each of these is like maybe a page or two pages at most. So the way I envision it, at least now, I don't want to like skip ahead of the group too much, but I see us sort of drawing... connections between all these different scenarios and showing somehow like the landscape of his thinking and how, where they all lie in that.
Cool. Okay. Well, thanks again. You've been listening to Darshiv on 91.7 WHUS Stores. I was joined again with Wes Hamrick, who is a Mellon Fellow at Greenhouse Studios, and Tom Lee, who is a design technologist at Greenhouse Studios, located on the first floor of the Homer Babbage Library. Gentlemen, thanks again for being on the show, and I look forward to finishing up Husky Review with you guys.
Great. Thanks for having us, Graham.
Thanks, Graham.
All righty. Take it easy. You've been listening to another episode of Darshiv on 91.7 WHUS Stores. You can find out more about the Yukon Archives and Special Collections at Yukon Archives on Twitter and Facebook. Subscribe on iTunes or listen online at whus.org. Our theme song is Dream in Casio Tone by Arable Lands, graphic design by Melica Bloom. I'm your host, Graham Stinnett. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.